From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And coming up, as the Army reduces troop numbers, how is it preparing soldiers for civilian life?
But first, that emotional meeting yesterday at the UN Security Council as members viewed a video purporting to show a chlorine gas attack in northwest Syria. The video was shown by a doctor. He said it was filmed last month as he and other doctors attempted unsuccessfully to revive three children aged 1 to 3. The government of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad denies responsibility. U.S. Ambassador Samantha Power says individuals who are responsible will be held accountable. But how should the U.S. respond? Nicholas Burns is a member of Secretary of State John Kerry's Foreign Affairs Policy Board, a former U.S. ambassador to NATO, also professor at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. So, Ambassador, Professor, you said we can call you Nick. Nick, your reaction to this news of another possible chemical weapons attack in Syria?
Well, Robin, it's reprehensible. It's tragic. The fact that these weapons targeted civilians and that young kids were their victims, something has to be done. And I think the United States, through some Ambassador Samantha Power, spoke with great passion and conviction. But unfortunately, the reality is Russia will probably protect Syria at the UN Security Council.
Yeah, well, Russia, of course, an ally of Syria. And we have Syria denying it was involved. Now, others are saying these chemical bombs, if you will, were dropped by helicopters. And there's a sense that it had to have been Assad's work. What is the sense of who might have been behind this?
I think there's little doubt that the Syrian military was behind this. It was their area of operation. They are the only military unit that has access to helicopters. They have done this time and again. We know they used chemical weapons twice in 2013, and we know they've dropped just in recent days these huge barrel bombs of cluster munitions on civilian neighborhoods near Aleppo. So they are certainly, I think, the guilty party here. And there is an organization, Robin, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. It's a Nobel Prize winning organization 2 years ago in The Hague. They should investigate this.
Yeah, and I just want to be clear, listeners, here, the accusation from the doctors and the people who brought the video was from the use of chlorine to attack this group of people in March. But then subsequently, there's been reports of another attack of chemical weapons, barrel bombs that were dropped. But Syria had agreed to dismantle its chemical weapons program. So what do you think is happening here politically? Because there's also this messy sort of burbling up of consideration of Assad, maybe even partnering somehow in the fight against ISIS. Do you think he's feeling maybe empowered in hearing some of that?
Well, two things. First, this is a government that for many, many years has been mendacious. They've simply lied. They've misrepresented the truth about their actions. Secondly, it's a desperate government. They control less and less of Syrian territory. This government will never put Syria back together again. One-third of their territory is controlled by the Islamic State. And it may be that their military commanders are taking measures into their own hands and using these weapons that are prohibited, as you know, Robin, under international law. So that might be an explanation for this. But you're right to point to the complexity for the United States. There's another big humanitarian issue in Syria. More than half the population, more than 11 million people, are now homeless from this war. 250,000 dead. This is the most catastrophic human rights situation in the world today. So the speculation has been in recent weeks the United States perhaps might have to begin to work with this Syrian government again simply to get aid into the refugees. But after these reports, I think that makes that a very difficult trade-off.
Well, and so how should the U.S. respond, if at all?
Well, the United States, I think Samantha Power, Ambassador Power, responded, I thought, very effectively yesterday. Here's how we could follow up. We need to press the Russian government, certainly the Iranian government. They are the protectors of the Assad regime, to, number one, allow an independent United Nations investigation into the use of chemical weapons against civilians in recent weeks. Number two, to allow the United Nations to make a plan to bring relief aid to the Jordanian-Syrian border and the Turkish-Syrian border to half the population that are on the run from these vicious terrorist groups and the vicious Syrian government. You know, sometimes in international politics, it's a shame culture. You want to shame another government into acting. Moscow and Tehran should be ashamed of their protection of this regime.
Former Ambassador Nick Burns, thank you.
Thanks very much.
Well, a survey being reported on in this morning's edition of USA Today finds Army morale is low, despite the fact that the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are officially over. According to the survey, more than half of soldiers say they are pessimistic about their future in the military, and nearly half say they have little satisfaction in their jobs. And now, with troop cuts looming, the Army is telling soldiers they should start thinking about civilian life. Julia Botero of Here and Now contributor North Country Public Radio went to Fort Drum in New York and has our story.
First Lieutenant Jumbela Coot is from Queens, New York. He signed up for the Army when he was a freshman in college. The Army agreed to pay for his education in exchange for 4 years of service. Coot graduated in 2009 when President Obama was sending even more troops to Afghanistan. He entered the Army as an infantryman.
Back in those days, it was granted. It was, hey, you are going to go to war. Do you still want to do it?
Coot said yes. A few months later, he was in Afghanistan. He deployed there twice, earning a Purple Heart and a Bronze Star. In 2014, he was in the midst of advising Afghani security forces when a superior officer approached him. Coot was told to leave the Army immediately.
I was literally just handpicked and said, you need to go, leave now, in the middle of everything. That was a little heartbreaking.
While Coot was leading soldiers through a war zone, a promotions board was reviewing his files. It was time for Lieutenant Coot to move up to captain, but...
Unfortunately for me, the Army decided I couldn't make the captain's list. From the moment that they decided I didn't make the captain's list, I was given 7 months to get out of the Army.
During the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, an officer could move up the ranks quickly. The Army needed leaders for the thousands of recruits. Now, sequestration, part of the 2011 Budget Control Act, is forcing the Army to shrink. So Army officials are deciding who can stay and who must go. The records of officers and the enlisted will be scrutinized by selection boards every year until the size of the force is reduced by 70,000 soldiers.
We're training some new folks in, so it's a little busy.
The transitions office at Fort Drum near Watertown, New York, is streaming with dozens of soldiers. This is where they come for help when planning to leave the Army. They're at computers, updating resumes, scrolling through job listings, and talking to counselors. Lori Guler is the head of Fort Drum's transition office. She gives me a tour.
They are trying to make up their mind whether they want to stay in, leave the military. So there are all kinds of different options out there for them.
More than 6,000 soldiers at Fort Drum are eligible to start the long process of transitioning out. Some who've already left the Army find it hard to get back on their feet.
That's peer-to-peer, Jay speaking.
Just a few miles away from the base, Justin Gregory Blodgett is volunteering at the Watertown Vets Outreach Center. He was discharged honorably from the Army in 2013 after 14 years of service. He's now unemployed.
I was pissed. I was pretty angry. I was like, well, you know, I wanted to stay in and make a career out of it.
Blodgett deployed to Afghanistan 4 times. On this last mission, he said he injured his hip in a helicopter crash. After surgery, Blodgett said he was told he wouldn't be able to fight again.
As an infantryman, our job is to, you know, go out there and go after the bad guys. But I couldn't do that anymore because of my injury, so.
This is a fairly common process every time that we've had to draw down a force.
Lisa Mundy teaches military history at the University of St. Thomas in Houston, Texas. She says cuts are common after big combat missions. Even healthy soldiers in good standing are asked to leave.
When you're drawing down, you have to start making the cut somewhere. It's simply a matter of this is, you know, what Congress has decided the end strength is going to be and the budget's going to be, and this is what we have to do to reach those goals.
Soldiers know that, but off the record, many express frustration with the process, especially those who've deployed 4 or 5 times. They've left their families repeatedly for months. Many moved up their ranks and enjoy the responsibilities and the pay of an officer. They say the uncertainty is nerve-wracking, and it stings to be told you aren't good enough.
To visit, we will be in Denver this weekend.
First Lieutenant Jumbela Coot is sitting in his living room typing out emails on his laptop. Coot faces new challenges in the civilian world. He's going back to school, and he'll be living on a budget. And he'll have to figure out how to replace the thrill he found in combat with a new passion.
When that adrenaline rushes, when that first snap, The crackle of the bullets whiz and the explosions happen. It's addicting. It's a high that you can't get anywhere else.
Akut isn't bitter about the end of his Army career, but he says he'll miss being part of a larger global mission. Now his new assignment is to simply focus on himself.
Just kind of wrap my head around this concept of being in charge of everything that has to do with me starting now, which is very, it's like I said, it's still, it's a very, it's hard, it's tough to swallow because it's been so, my life up to now has been so structured.
More soldiers may find themselves in Lieutenant Akut's position. Additional cuts are expected across the country as the Army tries to trim 70,000 troops from its ranks by 2017. Another review of officers and enlisted records is tentatively scheduled for September. For Here and Now, I'm Julia Botero.
It's Here and Now, and I'm in Washington, D.C. today, where tourists are coming in droves right now to check out the cherry blossoms, the museums, the memorials on the National Mall. I stopped by the Jefferson Memorial yesterday to meet with Interior Secretary Sally Jewell, who is currently promoting a campaign to get more young people and minorities to visit national parks. She points to the success of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt's Civilian Conservation Corps, or CCC, as connecting a previous generation to public lands, which she says laid the groundwork for the support the national parks have had over the decades. But today, she's facing a new generation that is less connected to the parks. As we walk along the tidal basin, park rangers come up and show their adoration for Jewell. But she says not everyone is a fan of hers.
Well, I think when you're running the Department of Interior, you're balancing an awful lot of competing interests. Protecting lands, but also allowing access to our natural resources. Part of the mission of the Park Service is to protect these special assets unimpaired for future generations, and yet you need to allow people to come and visit. And so how do you strike that right balance on the right level of visitation, but also leaving them unimpaired for future generations? And that's tricky. So we're always trying to strike a balance between how much we love our parks and how much we protect our parks. And that's true for my broad portfolio in Department of Interior as well.
Well, and there are others who would say they want to be able to do more drilling. They want to be able to get access to the resources that are being protected.
Yeah, that's true. I will say that in national parks, there is no drilling and we do protect the resources. But there are a lot of public lands in the Department of Interior's portfolio and the federal family, Forest Service, for example, that don't have any levels of protection or very minimal levels of protection. And some of them are appropriate for development of resources because they don't have other special attributes to them, and others are too special to develop. So I'll use the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge as an example. It's a wildlife refuge. It was set up for that purpose. There is probably oil and gas under there, but we do not believe that's appropriate to develop, and we've made that position clear as an administration. There's also a National Petroleum Reserve in Alaska. It's got some special places that we've put off limits for oil and gas activities, but it's got a lot of the land that is appropriate for oil and gas activity and also has resources. So that's part of how I balance this job.
Well, do you think that right now, the way that things are set up and what's protected and what's not protected, that we have the right balance right now?
No, I think that we need to continue to do a better job of pulling up and understanding our landscapes. So, for example, when Yellowstone National Park was set aside in the late 1800s, we set it aside for the areas that we knew were special, the geothermal features and those kinds of things. And the reality is we now understand that Yellowstone's ecosystem is much bigger than what we have just with Yellowstone National Park. So it's been a very concentrated effort for many years, something called Crown of the Continent, to connect protected areas and corridors where wildlife can migrate, for example, and the ecosystem can thrive that goes well outside the park's boundaries. And that is by working with private landowners and conservation easements and conservation organizations, as well as the Bureau of Land Management, the Forest Service, other landowners in that corridor to recognize that there are areas that needed more protection than we'd had in the past. So as we get smarter, as we understand our landscapes more, we need to continue to adjust our land management practices.
I should say, as we're talking here, we're walking past the cherry blossoms, which I guess we missed the peak by a few days, but they're still pretty lovely.
Yes, gorgeous.
What about maintenance? You're not dealing with an enormous budget at the Department of the Interior, and a report last month from the Park Service found that the agency had to delay a lot of maintenance projects, $11.5 billion worth. How do you get Congress to give you the money that you need to maintain the parks?
Well, we need to make a case for the parks, and so do constituents, so that members of Congress recognize this is a priority for the people in their districts and the people in their states. We do have an $11.5 billion maintenance backlog. Half of that is transportation. So you think about the crumbling roads and bridges that people travel on across the country. That is very true in national parks, and that would have been funded out of a transportation package that we are about to run out of money on. So that's one illustration. Congress passes legislation that increases the number of national parks, but we have not now for a number of years increased the budget to address that maintenance and operation, and I think it's, you know, critically important that we do so.
Well, and I was surprised to hear, by the way, that 80% of Americans know about the National Park Service, but less than half that number can actually tell you what they do.
I think that's true. I mean, maybe 80% of the Americans can say there is a National Park Service, but I would say a small fraction, much less than half, can actually name a lot of the national parks that are probably quite close to where they are. Many of them tell stories of our culture and our history. I think they think about iconic large national parks, but they don't think about the Civil War battlefields or the Revolutionary War battlefields or the stories of the Underground Railroad or the Civil Rights Movement. And these are all stories that are told in the national parks all around the country. So part of the Find Your Park campaign is going to be challenging people to take a look and recognize there's some really very close by.
The Find Your Park campaign is Jewel's initiative to get Americans, especially young Americans, to realize the parks that are around them. In front of the Jefferson Memorial, there's a digital kiosk that allows you to video chat with visitors at other parks. You can also spin a dial in any direction, and it'll tell you how far you are from the Grand Canyon or Yellowstone. We were just feet away from the monument to FDR.
Let's walk over here for a second. Let me just show you. The bread line that they have from the Great Depression. And at the top he says, "I see one-third of a nation ill-housed, ill-clad, ill-nourished." He says, "The test of our progress is not whether we add more to the abundance of those who have much, it is whether we provide enough for those who have too little." So that's a good illustration of the Great Depression and what was driving his thought process at that time. And if we walk this way, you'll see the formation of the CCC and his vision for putting young American men to work on our public lands. And some of them are still living. They're in their 90s now. But the experience in the CCC shaped who they are. And that's very much something that we're trying to bring back right now, is a connection from young people to public lands through service.
This is something that obviously means a lot to you.
I know. It's true.
What is it that just made you feel that way?
I see our country polarizing. I see people with opportunity. I had opportunity, my kids had opportunity, and I see a lot of people without opportunity. I've been out on hundreds of service projects with young people who have done work on public lands, and it has changed their lives. That's what happened in the CCC. That's what can happen today. The work in nature and on public lands gives people inspiration to see careers that they otherwise have not seen. It gives puts things like park rangers and wildlife biologists and historians and caretakers of the land on the radar of people that don't see those jobs in their future, and I think that's very important. So he says, "I propose to create a civilian conservation corps to be used in simple work. More important, however, than the material gains will be the moral and spiritual value of such work." He recognized that a large unemployed citizenry or underemployed citizenry was destroyed their confidence, and that giving them work would give them both moral and spiritual value. And as I look at the challenges that we had in our Great Recession on employment, and I look at the challenges of young people as they put themselves through school, which is very expensive today, they get out of school and they're looking for meaningful work, that's difficult. We'll say that in the youth core work that I have done with the kids that have led me, whether I'm pulling invasive species or building trail, that I see in them strong moral and spiritual values and a sense of confidence they wouldn't have otherwise have had.
Is it time to renew that, to do that again, in a way to, especially at a time when youth unemployment is so high in this country?
I think it is, and I will say that we're doing that. In the Department of Interior, we have a youth initiative. I don't have enough money in the budget to support it, and so I've gone to the private sector, and companies have stepped up. Companies like American Eagle Outfitters, which was first to the table. Companies like American Express and REI and Coca-Cola, Camelback, a number of them have said, we're willing to support your work, and we're working with the nonprofit community as well. So the official name is the 21st Century Conservation Service Corps. I like to call it CCC 2.0. It's saying, okay, maybe the federal government's not going to write a check to get all these underemployed or unemployed young people out working on public lands, but maybe the private sector can help, and they are. So it's another way that they're working not only to support Youth Conservation Corps crews, which we are putting to work, but they're also engaging their employees in coming out and volunteering, and they're giving these young people a hiring preference when they're done. And all of those things are really important because, you know, we want young people to feel great about the opportunities that they have.
Sally Jewell, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Sally Jewell, Secretary of the Interior, speaking with us at the FDR Memorial next to the Tidal Basin in Washington. You can hear more of our conversation about Sally Jewell's plans to get young people and minorities to visit national parks at hereandnow.org.
And today, three federal judges in New Orleans are hearing arguments to decide whether or not to lift another judge's ban on President Obama's actions on immigration. You remember last November, the president announced the executive actions to protect 5 million undocumented immigrants from deportation and to issue them temporary work permits. That was after comprehensive immigration reform stalled in Washington. But in February, a Texas judge froze those actions. So today's hearings start deliberations on whether that order should be lifted. Josh Gerstein, senior reporter for Politico. And Josh, it was actually a group of 26 states led by Texas that opposed the president's policies. What was their argument?
Well, their argument is that the president doesn't have the authority under law or under the Constitution to take these sorts of actions, that if he wants a change in immigration policy that significant, you mentioned probably 5 million people affected by his decisions to grant deferred action to certain groups of illegal immigrants, that he should go to Congress and get something passed. And the simple fact that Congress hasn't passed anything doesn't give him the authority to take those kinds of moves.
There was the unconstitutional argument, but also they argued that it would be a hardship for them.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the reason that they say they have standing to object here. You might ask, well, why does the state of Texas have a reason to come into court? And their explanation is, well, things like driver's licenses and other kinds of state services, they have a duty to provide them to people if they have some sort of working papers. They can get Social Security numbers and work permits through these kinds of programs, and then they're entitled to additional state benefits, which these 26 states say cost them something. It should be mentioned there are about 10 to 15 states on the other end of the argument who say that they think it's actually a net benefit for their states and they don't feel injured by this in any way.
Yeah. Meanwhile, with the president's orders up in the air, what is the status of these immigrants?
Well, they basically remain in the same position they're in, although the president's orders are not completely suspended at this point. This judge did prohibit giving new work permits and these deferred action kind of deportation deferrals to individuals. However, he didn't overturn the actual prioritization of which illegal immigrants the administration would try to get out of the country first. And so a lot of these individuals really face little chance of being deported unless they commit a serious crime, for example. people. But their ability to really stay in the U.S. and thrive is limited by the fact that they can't get legal jobs through legal means because they don't have a work permit. And that's really what this Obama immigration move is all about.
Well, as you mentioned, the appeal is being decided by this three-judge panel. It's going to take a while. It's weeks and maybe longer. But what happens if they don't lift the ban?
Well, it's a complicated situation. The hearing that's taking place is actually about whether they lift it while these appeals go forward. If they don't lift the ban, it's a real problem for the administration. I mean, they will go probably to the Supreme Court and ask the Supreme Court to step in with an emergency action. But if that doesn't happen, it could really snag this whole program for 6 months, maybe a year or more. And given the fact that President Obama's term in office is already starting to wind down, he has only about, a year and 8 months left, if they can't get the program started soon, they're really going to face a lot of logistical problems, even if the courts ultimately conclude that he does have the authority to pursue it.
Okay, so it's an ongoing story. We'll stay on it with you. Josh Gerstein, a senior reporter for Politico. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, it's time now for a special Washington, D.C. edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
And there goes the last DJ.
Rob Bamberger is the longtime host of Hot Jazz Saturday Night on WAMU in Washington, D.C. And when I say longtime, we're talking 35 years. He joins us now. Rob, welcome to Here and Now. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be here with you. Thank you, Jeremy.
And you have long offered listeners of WAMU the reprieve from all of the news and information that they get to hear all day long with a little jazz. And let's get to some of that right now. And we're focusing today on vintage jazz and swing from the 1920s through the 50s and 60s. And you first wanted us to hear a 1926 recording of the jazz pianist Jelly Roll Morton and his Red Hot Peppers. This is Black Bottom Stomp. And Jelly Roll Morton, we should say, has a D.C. connection.
That's right. He lived here in Washington, D.C. in the mid and late 1930s at the time that he made a series of wonderful oral history recordings with Alan Lomax at the Library of Congress. But he also had a little club that changed its name about two or three times. And the building happens to be located next to a very famous D.C. landmark, and that's Ben's Chili Bowl.
Ben's Chili Bowl. Yes, a very famous landmark. And tell us about Black Bottom Stomp.
Morton's a figure who has been rather easily marginalized in some of the broader tellings of the history of jazz. This is in part because Morton alienated the generation of musicians that came after him with his boasts. But in the Black Bottom Stomp, a recording, incidentally, that was added to the Library of Congress National Sound Registry, that record sums up in 3 minutes the essence of New Orleans jazz and what differentiates it from Dixieland, Dixieland being a music that relies on a string of soloists sandwiched in between an opening and a closing ensemble. But New Orleans music is a music that relies on the ensemble, the front line of the trumpet, clarinet, and trombone, all having different but complementary functions that allow all three instruments to play simultaneously without creating a musical hash. Morton was really one of the first jazz musicians to have a true aesthetic about how the ensemble and the soloists should be brought into balance. And the Black Bottom Stomp is as perfect a statement of that New Orleans tradition as just about any example one could offer.
Well, let's get to another song from the 20s. This is a 1928 recording of Jimmy Johnson and his orchestra. This is called Chicago Blues. Thank you. really were happy back in the 20s, weren't they?
They were indeed. One of the greatest musical mentorships was the friendship between Harlem pianist James P. Johnson and his very apt pupil, Thomas Fats Waller. And on this record, about a minute and a half into it, Johnson's and Waller's pianos come welling out from the ensemble like a brook that has been set on high effervescence. And the 30 seconds that follows, I think, are among the most joyful ever committed to record. I love it musically, but also because it seems to be an extraordinary expression of what lay between these two musicians, mentor and pupil, just a shared, unmitigated joy in music.
You know, that was the best simile I have heard in so long, like a brook that has been set on high effervescence. Well done, sir.
Thank you.
Let's get to another one of your picks. This is Artie Shaw and his orchestra featuring Tony Pastor on vocals. This is Prashai from 1939.
Prashai, goodbye. Prashai, let's kiss and say farewell. Prashai, goodbye. Prashai, I leave my heart. Prashai, goodbye. Prashai, oh, play it, Arthur, play it. Prashai, goodbye. Prashai, I leave my heart.
Rob, what is it that you love about this one?
If someone were to ask me to choose the top three examples of what the swing era was all about, that performance is one that I would pick, which is from a 1939 broadcast. Artie at the time was furnishing music on a radio program hosted by the comedian, actually he was really more of a monologist, Robert Benchley. And that air check is among the most exciting examples of a swing band in full abandon.
Well, we have time for one more of your selections. This is from Kid Howard's Olympia Band. This is a 1962 recording of Don't Give Up the Ship. Say, Rob, even something from the 60s like this sounds quite different from the kind of jazz that we would hear today.
Your observation, Jeremy, really gets at the heart of what's going on there. What you're hearing there is a recording that was part of a wave of recordings made in New Orleans, mostly by collectors and people interested in documenting the early history of music in turn of the century New Orleans, who went scouring about and gathering together musicians who, by and large, never left the city, but were furnishing music back in the 19-aughts and the 1910s. And the producers of recordings like these were sort of chasing after the lost chord. There were no indigenous recording studios in New Orleans. We really have no idea what the music sounded like at the turn of the century. So these sessions were made in the hope that we were having some glimpse into that past music. But the wonderful, almost delicious thing about that track is Don't Give Up the Ship was a pop tune written in Hollywood by Al Dubin and Harry Warren, who wrote songs for a ton of Warner Brothers musicals. And Don't Give Up the Ship came out of a 1935 movie called Shipmates Forever, and it would seem like it was from another planet so far as New Orleans jazz is concerned, but it was a tune that Kid Howard was playing back in the mid-30s. So the lost chord, it isn't. But what an infectious New Orleans turn on a Hollywood movie musical pop tune. You just can't find anything like that performance of Don't Give Up the Ship.
Rob Bamberger, the longtime host of Hot Jazz Saturday Night on WAMU here in Washington, D.C. Rob, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Been a great pleasure. Hope you'll have me back.
Hope you'll have me back. You can hear all our DJ session picks at our Spotify playlist. That's on Spotify. Just search for NPR Here and Now, or you can find them at our website, hereandnow.org.
Thousands of runners are once again descending on Boston for Monday's marathon. Only a handful have a chance to win. And Here Now's Alex Ashlock spoke with some of those elite runners today. He's back in the studio. Alex, hi.
Good afternoon.
And remind people just maybe paying attention to all of this. You know, sometimes it's your first noticing the Boston Marathon. There are marathons all over the world. Yes, this one had a terrible event 2 years ago.
Right.
But even before that, it got a lot of attention. Why?
Well, Robin, it's really old. It's even older than I am. It dates back to 1897. It's the world's oldest annual marathon, comparing to New York, which started its race in 1970, or London, which is coming up a week from Sunday, held its first race in 1981. What also makes it different is from the other big city marathons is that it's always held on a holiday, a Monday, Patriots Day here in Massachusetts, marking the shot heard around the world. So it's a day that everybody has the day off.
Right.
So they all come out and watch.
Huge celebration. Yes. Apologies to the rest of the country. We have an extra holiday. So the runners in this year's race, who will set themselves apart?
You have to start with the men, and you have to start there with Meb Keflezighi. He's the defending champion, a very emotional victory last year, the year after the bombings. Meb was the first American to win the open race in 31 years. He's back this year to try to repeat.
I'm feeling pretty good. You know, it's great to be back here in Boston. And you know, I'm excited for the competition and looking forward to, you know, see what brings. I feel I'm one piece, which is huge as you get older to stay healthy. But, you know, I'm here and in one piece and hopefully ready to go.
There's Meb Keflezighi, your running partner. You know, he mentions he's healthy. That's something that wasn't guaranteed for his family. They fled civil war. They eventually made their way to California. He excelled as a runner. He's obviously world class.
He's incredible. He finished second in the 2004 Olympic marathon more than a decade ago. He won a silver medal there in Athens. He also won the New York Marathon in 2009. He's about to turn 40 years old, Robin, and he thinks he can win this race again. And he's also going to try to make another Olympic team in 2016.
So what's his competition? Before he won last year, African runners dominated the Boston Marathon for two decades. So might there be Kenyans or Ethiopians challenging Meb?
I think you can count on that. Mm-hmm. Last year, the other runners in the field basically watched him as he took the lead early in the race. He just kept extending it. And by the time they tried to reel him in, he had crossed the finish line as the winner. That isn't going to happen on Monday. There are two other past champions in the race, including Kenyan Wesley Karir. He happens to be a member of the Kenyan Parliament. There's also Lalissa Desisa of Ethiopia. He's a past champion. Patrick Macau of Kenya, running the Boston Marathon for the first time. He's a former world record holder. This morning, I spoke to Amby Burfoot. He won the Boston Marathon way back in 1968. He's covered the race now for decades for Runner's World magazine.
The field is immense this year. The chance of anybody winning it is 1 in 20. But, you know, Meb is going to be running on such a tidal wave of emotion and support. I don't know how that's going to work out for him, but if lightning struck last year, maybe it can strike again this year, too.
Okay, so maybe lightning in the men's race, but we know for sure that's not going to happen in the women's race.
No lightning in the women's race. The winner from last year, Rita Jeptu, she's a Kenyan, tested positive for a performance-enhancing drug last year. Mm-hmm. That was before the Chicago Marathon in the fall. She also won that race after she had won Boston. She's now been suspended for 2 years, and there's a lot of speculation, Robin, about how she won the Boston race last year. I was on the women's press truck in front of Jeptu and the other runners in that race, and at around 24 miles, she just accelerated and just left everybody behind. It was really incredible. Now people are wondering about that. She set a course record that day, but American Shalane Flanagan, one of the runners she left behind, doesn't think it should stand.
No. No. I mean, more information needs to come to light, and it may be unfair for me to say that just because she didn't test positive at Boston last year. However, there's some incriminating evidence, supposedly, that she has been doping for a while. And so if that comes true, if that is true, yeah, I would say Diba is the course record holder.
And Diba is Ethiopian Bazunesh Diba. She finished second last year. Flanagan, by the way, was seventh. She's trying to become the first American woman to win the race since 1985.
Well, in the couple minutes we have, I just want to talk a bit about the wheelchair portion of the race. Wheelchairs entered the marathon in 1975. Now they're a huge part of the marathon.
Yeah, it's really incredible to watch them as well. Hard to believe now that it's been 40 years since they first became part of the race because we see the Paralympics each year. One of the great champions in the wheelchair races is Ernst van Dijk of South Africa. He has 10 titles here in Boston, more than anyone in the history of the race.
Boston set the bar for all the other races on how to treat wheelchair athletes, how to include them, how to give them equal exposure and incorporate them into the event like professional athletes. So this race, with all its history, with all it's done, and the way it helped to make my career, is just very special to me.
Robin, we should also mention Tatiana McFadden. She's the defending champion in the women's wheelchair race. You've spoken to her, you know her story. A Russian, an orphan in Russia, adopted by an American family. She sued successfully to compete with, I guess, able-bodied athletes, if you will.
Yeah.
And now she's going for her third straight win in the Boston Marathon.
And we're all going to be covered by Alex Ashlock on Monday. You know, there's stories for everyone, even if you don't think you know a thing about running.
30,000 runners, 30,000 stories.
That's right.
And you're not that old, Alex, by the way.
And you aren't either. Alex, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Robin.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.